From KUOW Seattle, this is The Week in Review. I'm Marcy Silman. Congress went back to Washington, D.C. this week expecting to vote on military action against Syria. Instead, on Tuesday, President Obama addressed the nation.
I have therefore asked the leaders of Congress to postpone a vote to authorize the use of force while we pursue this diplomatic path.
Well, diplomacy is now the watchword of the Obama administration. Syria, one of the big stories this week. Certainly not the only thing making headlines, but at times it does seem like that. Joining me to talk about the week's news, as they do most weeks, our esteemed panel of journalists, Joni Balter, assistant political editor for the Seattle Times, back from a hiatus in the moss-covered rainforest, Knut Berger, the moss back at crosscut.com. Good to see you. Cleaned
Thanks,
up.
Marcy. Good to be back.
And Eli Sanders, associate editor at The Stranger, is here as well. Hello.
Nice to be here.
All right. Well, let's start with the I don't even know where, because things were happening so fast. Last week, Eli and Joni were here, and Knut, you were out blessedly away from the week's events. And we all thought Congress was heading back on Monday, and they were going to vote on Wednesday about what to do with Syria, whether to give Obama and his administration the go-ahead to do military intervention. And then on Monday, Russia and Syria said, oh, yeah, you know, we want to talk about it, and we'll give up our chemical weapons that we didn't have the week before. And now John Kerry and the Secretary Lavrov of Russia are meeting in London, or maybe not meeting, as the case may be, because that is changing moment by moment. And so we wait.
But it's a lot different, as you said, for all those members of Congress who were flying back, were headed to these intelligence briefings. They were facing the toughest vote. There was a story that came out that said not one member of our delegation had decided exactly how to vote. Even Jim McDermott, who you would normally think and had been talking very decisively about how he really was opposed to any such military strike, said he could go anyway.
Well, I want to play another cut from the president, who kind of started off making his case for why we should intervene and then making a case for why we weren't going to intervene. And he answered, or at least addressed, something that's been on a lot of people's minds.
America's not the world's policeman. Terrible things happen across the globe, and it is beyond our means to right every wrong. But when, with modest effort and risk, we can stop children from being gassed to death and thereby make our own children safer over the long run, I believe we should act.
It's a very interesting, it was an interesting speech. I'm not sure if, were you back in civilization?
Yes.
Okay, so did all three of you hear this very brief speech for this president, 16 minutes? Did any of you, what did you take away? Let me rephrase that. What did you take away as the message from it?
Well, it seemed like a speech that was written with the expectation that he would be announcing the beginning of missile strikes. And then because events were changing so quickly, it became an announcement that he was asking Congress not to vote. Or at least maybe he thought it would be an announcement that he had the authorization and was prepared to use it soon. So it clearly was a speech that went through some evolution in reaction to Kerry's comment that the Russians then took him up on, that if Syria offered to give up its chemical weapons, it could forestall this attack. The question is whether they're playing for time, the Russians and the Syrians, Syria in particular, or whether there's something real here, and that seems to be the position of the Obama administration. We want to see something real happen. The political question is how Obama will be viewed as a result of all this. There are a lot of people saying this is a sign of weakness. This is a sign of indecision. This is he's kind of like a cork bobbing in the sea of world events, is how I think someone put it. There's also the view that I take at the moment, which is that this is the best possible outcome. If indeed we have we see Syria give up chemical weapons or put them under international control, then just by threatening and by being flexible with the course of events, we've been able to, without firing any missiles, without any, you know, civilian casualties, get Syria to give up its chemical weapons, which was the goal in the first place and wouldn't have been accomplished by firing missiles.
Knut, I'm trying to remember what the situation was 2 weeks ago before you headed out into the wilderness, because you mentioned to us before we went on the air that all this happened while you were incommunicado. So were we planning, the attack proposed at that point?
When I went on vacation, we were talking about Miley Cyrus and twerking.
You know, wow.
Which we're still talking about. So it was kind of like coming back from the woods, and you know, I missed most of the "Are we going to attack?" All the kind of back and forth. And so I kind of was picking it up.
Wow, that must have been like landing from outer space.
Yeah, well, it was sort of, you know, it was a surprise. It's sort of like, well, we're going to war?
What I miss?
Yeah, obviously we missed something. It was interesting. So I obviously went back and looked at a lot of stuff, and I've been trying to catch up and follow up. I mean, I thought Obama, if you look at it as where we are now, and don't pay attention to the previous couple of weeks, it's not such a bad thing. I mean,
yeah. I want to play just one last cut from this speech, because one thing that happened, and I'm not sure how much this played into the president, in addition to the announcement by Russia and Syria that they were willing to talk and give up these chemical weapons, but it became more and more clear that the American public, I think, overwhelmingly, Eli had been polling on the slog, and it was like
where the American public registers all of its opinions.
Well, where some of Seattle's public is, but in states that you'd think would be hawk-ish, they haven't been hawk-like. So here's a president addressing that.
I will not put American boots on the ground in Syria. I will not pursue an open-ended action like Iraq or Afghanistan. I will not pursue a prolonged air campaign like Libya or Kosovo. This would be a targeted strike to achieve a clear objective, deterring the use of chemical weapons and degrading Assad's capabilities.
But not a pinprick.
Absolutely.
Because the American military doesn't do pinpricks, he also said.
He was addressing every concern that had come up pretty much in a very tight speech. My observation of it was that the first 12 minutes were the original speech of the 16-minute speech. And that, you know, and
the justification.
The justification for Congress to get behind what he and the American people to get behind what he was saying. And then you just sort of had this image that afternoon of them handing, get me rewrite, give me a new page, give me something different, because the story was shifting as he was about to deliver. But think about what you're all saying. This is now Putin's problem. He's on the line to make this happen. So the only thought I had about that was yesterday he wrote a piece in the New York Times, and it was a sensational moment for an editorial page to have Putin in there. He had one line in there I'm surprised remained, and that was, "No one doubts the poison gas was used in Syria, but there is every reason to believe it was used not by the Syrian army, but by opposition forces." Well, hold on a second here, because if you, Putin, are going to go settle this whole thing with the Syrian president, who now says, oh, yeah, I sort of do have some chemical weapons and I'll put them up if, how do you reconcile that?
Well, he made a lot of statements in that op-ed, which was a fascinating read, I thought.
It was a really amazing look into his worldview, or at least what he wants us to think of as his worldview. And, you know, an attempt at persuasion, maybe you'd say propaganda in some cases, but very, very interesting and refreshing to see.
Well, right at the top, he said, you know, we were opposed on this, but once we were allies, which hearkened to some kind of... it hearkened to World War II, but it felt very Shakespearean to me reading that. I don't know why.
I thought there was a really interesting thing in the speech, which was the nod to American exceptionalism, which Putin then took exception to. And that's a concept that, you know, Stalin didn't like that concept either. It's an old idea that Americans trot out from time to time, and it has a lot of different meanings. But Obama, in fact, has been criticized by Republicans, Romney, Huckabee, McCain for not believing in American exceptionalism. And Obama has said, well, yeah, I believe in American. I think we're exceptional. And I'm sure the Greeks think they're exceptional and everybody thinks they're. But what the right means, particularly the neocon group, is that America has a kind of Reaganistic, you know, city on the hill, New Jerusalem, kind of special God-given destiny to be exceptional. And I thought the fact that he used the word in the speech was an interesting kind of
Obama used the word.
The fact that he was saying we are exceptional in the speech is one of those dog whistles to the neocons to kind of keep them in the tent, because he may need them if, in fact, there has to be a military strike.
I thought it was very interesting, too, and a sign of just how desperate he was in trying to win people over. He doesn't like to make this argument, but he would to marshal support.
Well, the week before, he had been in St. Petersburg, Russia, trying to rally the American allies to his cause, and I kept getting lists like, these are the people, these are the countries that have signed on, and you're kind of like, really, this is it? And you know, it's the Canada, our nearest neighbor, is lending his moral support, nothing more than that. France is trying to lead the charge in the United Nations at this point in time. France, and I love France, and I love the French, but it's, you don't think of France as a world power the way you might even think of Britain at this point in time, which is morally supportive, but not going ahead.
Yeah, they also have a long history in the Middle East.
Yes, they do.
So they have a, you know, particular interest there. I mean, one thing that was really curious to me, I mean, first of all, diplomacy is always messy. The question is, how aware of the mess are we? You know, and in a society where we want things to be more transparent, more democratic, it's going to look pretty ugly. You're going to see sausage making in a way. I'm also interested, it was striking to me how people were very passionate about not going to war. Mm-hmm. And but I can't. Obama was getting criticized in two ways. I mean, he drew this red line. And when he finally said, well, what the red line means is, you know, if you use that gas, we're gonna send a missile into your munitions depots or whatever it is. Then he was criticized for doing too much. I mean, in other words, and I don't know how you conduct international diplomacy in that kind of a situation unless you carry a big stick along with big carrots. I mean, that's how it's done.
We're going to continue our conversation about Syria, but we're going to take a quick break here. Knut Berger, Joni Balter, Eli Sanders here with me, Marcy Silman, looking at the week in review. Syria on everyone's minds. This is KUOW.
Sixty-four degrees in Seattle. Expecting sunny skies this afternoon and a high today of 78.
I'm Bob Garfield. On this week's On the Media, the government is using the border as a backdoor for warrantless searches of American citizens.
What was called a text lookout had been created for him, basically saying, we're keeping an eye out for this guy. When he comes to the border, stop him, do a search, and seize his electronic media.
Don't miss this week's On the Media from WNYC.
Sunday night at 6 on KUOW 94.9 Seattle.
Evening tours of KUOW's broadcast facility are now available to listeners ages 15 and older. This month's evening tour is Thursday, September 19th at 6:15 p.m. Space is limited. To schedule a tour, call 206-543-2710 or email tours@kuow.org.
This is The Week in Review on KUOW. I'm Marcy Silman. We're talking over the week's news with Joni Balter, Eli Sanders, Knut Berger, and we're talking about Syria because it's so dominant. It's hard to get past that news. And Eli broached this a few minutes ago, the idea of why the president made this about-face. Congress was coming back. It was clear that he didn't have the support even from the staunchest of Democrats. And now the political pundits are pounding drums about how what Obama has done is the most disastrous thing that he didn't lobby Congress beforehand, before punting to them and telling them that they needed to deal with this and that you have to line up all your ducks, and essentially that this will be the defining moment of his two terms.
It totally depends on how it plays out. You know, he would have been criticized quite a bit if he hadn't gone to Congress, but by going to Congress, he opened up at least a week and perhaps many more now of all the opinions that 535 members of Congress have. He could end up with what will end up being called an accidental victory here. Hmm. But, you know, he didn't have the votes. He had gone to Russia. He didn't do so well with the Allies, as you mentioned before the break. He was drumming up the whole Tuesday speech was designed to drum up support among members of Congress. And there was a poll. Did anybody see that instant poll that CNN did right after the speech? And they came out, I think it was John King on CNN, and said, see, he's still below 50%. But the support for the military strike had gone up considerably from the speech, the instant one. I don't know what the long-lasting one was. So that was the original point of that whole speech when it was scheduled. And so the question is now, what happens next? And everyone, you know, this who's up, who's down, that's a good game. There's a long-term sort of review that shall be done here.
And it will be interesting to see whether this actually becomes defining. We've heard this and we've talked about it on a lot of these shows. Newtown is a defining moment. Mm-hmm. Healthcare reform, the defining moment. We've had so many things that were set up as the defining moment that, depending on your political persuasion, would determine that Obama is a rank failure or, you know, the best president we've ever had. And they don't linger in the consciousness. I think this is a way that Obama benefits from our short attention spans, unfortunately, or for the short attention spans of a lot of Americans, and for the decreased resources and news coverage. But so there's a question in my mind as to whether this will be defining at all. I think it will move very quickly to the back burner of people's minds if it goes into a kind of negotiated settlement phase, because what people were saying to the president, to Congress, is we don't want to think about Syria, and we don't want you thinking about Syria. We want you thinking about jobs and healthcare and things that we care about. We're tired of wars that bankrupt our country and ruin, you know, our standard of living or contribute to that ruin.
How much is all of this defined by the specter of George W. Bush?
Well, I think hugely, because I think there's been a great deal of distrust sown because of the Iraq War and the rationales for getting in. So even if you accepted the idea that a military strike was a good idea if certain things happened, et cetera, there's the whole question of, you know, is somebody fudging the intelligence? Mm-hmm. Do we really know what happened? And that you know, and I think it's the legacy of Colin Powell, I mean, going in front of the international community and basically selling a story that turned out not to be true. And then you have the financial picture created by the Iraq and Afghanistan, and I think people are disillusioned. It reminds me somewhat of kind of where we were between the two world wars, in the sense of the American public was tired of international problems. They were tired of sending their men and money overseas. There were a lot of – you see, I mean, the Republican Party, the isolationist wing of the Republican Party is now – ascendant in the Republican Party. This is a huge change from Bush years.
Right.
And part of it's because simply Obama's president, but also it represents the Rand Paul kind of Tea Party element, which is, you know, they talk out of both sides of their mouth in terms of, well, we want to be strong, but we don't want to get involved in anybody's business for any reason. And I think that's a really interesting shift that's going on here, because the party is swinging in a way that it's such a sea change, I think. Even from, can you imagine Republicans in the Reagan era arguing against using a military strike philosophically? I mean, they might have, you know, philosophically, no, they would have said,
yeah.
And you can see that split now with John McCain saying, I'm for a military strike,
more,
but only if it's big
more.
Enough.
More. This isn't enough for him.
Yeah, there's fatigue is what the polling is showing. The polling is referring to voters, and Maureen Dowd got, you know, captured this beautifully. They're sick of hearing of Sunnis versus Shiites, Alawites, you know, the whole everything over there that's historic and doesn't really affect me daily, that the voters, and especially many Republicans, are saying enough. They're tired of it. It's gone on too long.
You know, part of the fatigue that Knut was talking about in the post-World War II era is what led to the creation of the United Nations. Mm-hmm. And Putin, in his op-ed, referred to this and tried to cast what Obama was threatening as something that would destroy the United Nations. But there's this very interesting game going on where at the same time that Putin says that, the Russians are blocking every single effort to hold Syria accountable.
Right. I was just going to ask you about the role that the UN could play, because Russia is on the Security Council and has veto power. So four other countries could say, we're going to do something if this doesn't pan out, and if it's continually blocked by the one vote, which is how it works right now.
And Putin played that up in the op-ed.
Yes,
he said
did.
You don't go around the UN Security Council. You don't, unless, you know, you're under immediate threat. He played that up knowing he's got the veto.
Right. What he's saying is you don't go around me.
Me.
And there were a lot of little things like that in the op-ed that were sort of meant, in my interpretation, to needle Obama. These guys talk about their semi-functional relationship, is I think how both of them put it, in the best of, you know, days. And they spend a lot of time kind of poking at each other, and this op-ed was full of attempts to do that.
Well, one thing that I think one contrast between Obama and Bush in people's minds is some people's minds anyway, is that Obama looks weak.
Mm-hmm.
Bush projected, for better or worse, I thought worse, but I'm right, you're wrong. This is how we're going to do it, you know, type of approach. Obama has difficulty doing that because his own party doesn't support him on this. I mean, he is undercut by fellow Democrats in a way that Bush was not undercut. I mean, Bush had the support of a lot of Democrats, but he also had almost complete support from his own party. And it's very difficult for a president to go to Congress when the House is controlled by the other party, and they're not willing to support you on something that they would have supported Bush on. And so I think that there's a way in which they've created a situation in which it's impossible for Obama to look competent, and then they capitalize on his lack of competence by amplifying that.
But even if he had huge confidence and didn't feel lonely like we talked about last week, he's not a guy with a big swagger. Bush, just this is a personality thing in some ways. When Obama's feeling strong, he just kind of delivers these rhetorical beauties, you know, these speeches that are so compelling. But Bush just has a swagger when he gets up in the morning, you know.
I think he might be less conflicted intellectually. We're talking over the week's news with Joni Balter, Knut Berger, Eli Sanders, and now, as far as Syria goes, we wait, but I'm sure we'll be talking about this again next week. I want to move from what's happening internationally to the city of Seattle, where our mayor formally declared that he was running for mayor this week, and that kind of surprised me because I already thought he was a candidate.
He was certainly a candidate, but, you know, events are not a bad thing to do each day if you can get folks out, if you can get some cameras out there and some bloggers and journalists out there to say you had a moment. He was in Ballard. That's a neighborhood that he needs to get to win. As I recall, I don't know if it was Ballard or Magnolia, was a Bruce Harrell country in the primary. And so he's trying to solidify himself out there. I think I do remember that. He's out there trying to sort of shore up some support, a couple of fisticuffs with his challenger, Ed Murray, and on to the next event.
Well, quite a bit of fisticuffs. The race that we're going to see is going to be pugnacious.
Well, Ed Murray predicted it would be the ugliest that we've ever seen, and that prediction has become true. And now they're fighting over who made it ugly in the first place. You know?
Great. That's good. Well, they did have their first dual debate since the two men left standing. And as we said, it's not going to be pretty, but, you know, they're fighting who's more in the pocket of big business, who is more of a fat cat, who knows more about police reform, who's more of a leader. I mean,
who's more of a political failure, actually, seems to be one of them.
Ed Murray, you are a failure, is what McGinn is saying.
Murray says the same right back to him.
Yeah, it's the thing is always turning your opponent's strength into the weakness. And so Ed Murray's strength is legislative accomplishment and leadership in Olympia. Well, there are few things less popular than Olympia.
Right.
And so you hang that around his neck. You talk about all the things he didn't accomplish. You talk about his competence in overseeing various affairs, and you try and tag him as somebody whose leadership has been more not there than there on various issues that you can count, because Olympia always leaves an enormous list of stuff undone. That's the nature of that kind of legislative politics.
And there was more left undone this year than in past years because of its own congressional style split legislative body.
Well, we have two candidates here who agree mostly on the issues. And so they are having a hard time sort of slicing and dicing this thing. So one of the little themes here, I avoided meme because I'm tired of that word, is who's more establishment than the other. And so that one of the little debates they had this week was who's more in favor of business and who has more donations to their campaigns that are from business. And so they went around and around on that one. You know, so and there is an effort to paint Ed Murray as the establishment candidate. But this is a fascinating debate to me because Ed Murray would be the first gay mayor, fought for gay rights. How is that? Are the voters going to buy that as establishment?
Well, question. In a way, it's a sign of how far we come.
Yes.
We've come, that you actually can credibly stick someone with that tag, you know, even though they're from a minority group that is historically maybe thought of as totally outside of the establishment. I think in Washington State, where we have marriage equality in no small part due to Murray's efforts, it's just less of a presumption now. I think it's been so interesting to see McGinn, sorry, their names both begin with M's, and so they get jumbled in my mind, to see McGinn just methodically attempt to tear down, as Knut was saying, Murray's strength, his legislative record. And it must be galling to Murray to experience this because he's someone who's very proud of his legislative accomplishments. But he is in this trap where if he talks about violence in the city, McGinn comes back and says, what did you do about gun control? If he talks about working better with other people, McGinn comes back and says, what are you talking about? You lost control of the state Senate and caused all these problems. If he talks about transportation, McGinn says, what are you talking about? We're missing a huge amount of transportation funding because of the legislature's inaction. If he talks about schools, McGinn comes back and says, the Supreme Court says that the legislature over many years, all of which you were in the legislature, has failed to do its job at funding basic education. And so whenever the debate is on that terrain, which can be at almost any moment that McGinn chooses, Murray is in a very hard spot.
So what you're saying is that McGinn is totally steering the next 2 months?
He is trying to. And it will be interesting to see whether Murray can flip that dynamic.
Do you think he can, Knut?
Yeah, I do think he can, because McGinn is a really good campaigner, and I don't think anybody who's seen him would underestimate his ability to run a kind of, and in a sense, I mean, he has the advantage of the incumbent on the one hand. Daily emails of announcing.
Daily.
And now, have you noticed now, though, that the emails are the things are not symbolic, but they're money.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
You know, $500,000 for this, $5 million for that, $1 million. Okay.
And listeners, what we're talking about are press emails that come out of Mayor McGinn's office. And we get at least one or two a day, all the media in town announcing money for everything from community centers to, I can't remember.
Something for senior citizens, I saw. And many weeks ago, there was money for new police officers. So the city has has dough.
So, I mean, one of McGinn's strengths is that he's running an incumbent campaign with that ability, the publicity machine and the money machine, and he's running a guerrilla campaign at the same time, and he's pretty good at both of those. And Murray, so far, has been on the defensive and having to answer these issues, and he has to get beyond answering every specific detailed legislative question about some problem in Olympia when he was on a committee of 30 people and things didn't go right. I mean, some of the criticisms are absurd in their substance, but they're effective in getting your opponent back on his heels.
And the other thing that you're describing is McGinn's positioning himself as an outsider, really, at the same time.
As he's an insider.
But the problem for Murray is that his whole method of burnishing his credentials contributes to the view of himself as an insider, and his attacks on McGinn contribute to McGinn's ability to say, see, I'm an outsider. The establishment never liked me. It's never liked me in the city, and all these people who have never liked me and are part of the establishment like Murray.
This pro-business thing is interesting because every mayor we elect in recent times has been pro-business. They're all pro-business. But you cannot necessarily be seen to be pro-business. Nobody wants to run around town with a Chamber of Commerce tattoo on their forehead. So, that is, and McGinn is playing it just right. You know, McGinn is saying, well,
I like small business.
I like small business, and the big guys don't have the last word with me.
You know? I'm just waiting for you to roll up that sleeve and show me that Chamber of Commerce. But here's the thing about this business thing that's funny. What's the other choice? I'm anti-business? I mean, how does that work?
But what McGinn said, I'm pro-business, I'm with the little guys against the big guys, is, again, an indication of how really in line he is with the ethos in Seattle and with the politics of this city. Sometimes, if you look at that politics under a microscope, it doesn't make sense. It contains a lot of conflicting ideas. But he knows what Seattle wants to hear, which is that their mayor is pro-small business.
It was really interesting to me because during most of the primary, you heard about the police department as an issue, the police chief as an issue, but there wasn't a law and order candidate in the race. Bruce Harrell and Stadiker maybe came the closest on some issues. And so it's interesting now with the downtown, whether there's crime downtown or not, and has it gotten worse, what that situation is. And Murray, with the help of Harrell and Burgess and others, has kind of maneuvered himself into that kind of law and order slot, which I think is interesting.
I think it's all interesting. And before we take a break, I just have to ask, will there be issues that emerge for this campaign, or is this really going to be one of these sort of knockdown street fight kind of things?
Both, because the issues that will...
What will they be?
Well, one of the issues that has emerged, we just alluded to, is downtown safe? Stranger came out with a piece challenging some of the stats. Everyone's arguing over this. The sheriff's wife doesn't feel safe downtown. McGinn isn't arguing the point either because he coughed up $400,000 just in case, you know.
In case it's not safe.
But he's arguing about the facts. And I actually brought this up a couple of weeks ago here, that when you look at the statistics that are used, and we could come back to this after the break, but that they actually don't show a spike. They show pretty much a kind of flat line.
Hold that thought. Eli Sanders is associate editor of The Stranger, Knute Berger, The Mossback at Crosscut.com. Joni Balter, assistant political editor at The Seattle Times. I'm Marcy Silman. You're listening to KUOW's Week in Review.
-64 degrees in Seattle, heading towards a high today of 78, and the forecast calls for sun this afternoon.
Gathering data from a hurricane requires long hours of flying through the storm with sensitive instruments. Manned aircraft have limitations that drones don't.
That gives us that ability to extend our time when we're looking at these science phenomena over a weather system.
Using drones for non-military purposes. Later on All Things Considered from NPR News.
Beginning this afternoon at 2 o'clock on KUOW 94.9 Seattle.
Support for KUOW comes from the Seattle Sounders FC. The Sounders take on division leaders Real Salt Lake this Friday night at CenturyLink Field. More information and tickets for Friday's match at soundersfc.com.
It's 10:41. I'm Bernard Ouellette. Healthcare reform, a.k.a. Obamacare, takes effect on October 1st. And according to a recent poll, 50% of people don't understand how the law will work. And that confusion is fertile ground for con artists. We'll get some advice on avoiding the scammers this morning at 11:20.
It's the Week in Review here on KUOW. I'm Marcy Silman with our journalist roundtable, Joni Balter of the Seattle Times, Knut Berger, the Mossback at Crosscut, and the Strangers associate editor Eli Sanders. We were talking about the Seattle mayor's race, and we were talking about downtown crime, and it got me to thinking, Eli, you brought this up just before the break, you know, depends how you look at it. Data, to me, is something that anybody can make work to support what they want you to believe.
But as Ed Murray said in one of these feisty debates with McGinn the other day, you're not entitled to your own facts. He brought up that old line, which is very true. People can have all kinds of opinions and interpretations, but in the end, there are facts that we can dig up and put out there. And if people are willing to pay attention to them, they'll tell us a story. And so the crime issue, I think, is going to be the most glaring illustration of that over the next couple of weeks. We talked about that here a couple of weeks ago. Dominic Holden has a piece in this week's Stranger looking at the data, and Ed Murray says crime is up. Bruce Harrell, who was in the mayor's race until he wasn't because voters didn't pick him to get through the primary, is now supporting Murray and saying, yeah, crime is up. And all these other people are intimating in various ways that crime is up. And the Seattle Times had a story a while ago looking at some data that show crime increasing somewhat. But the reality is crime overall is down. We are at a 30-year low in violent crime in Seattle and really across the nation. There's a very strong dynamic pushing crime downward all over the country. And then in the city, if you lump in all the precincts in downtown Seattle rather than just a few, crime is also down.
Yeah, well, again, you can maneuver the which precincts you include or don't include and what you conclude is crime. I'll tell you what is a fact, and Ed Murray should be focusing on it, which is there whether crime is up or not, there are a lot of creeps downtown that hang out and make places like Westlake Park completely a place you would not want to hang out, especially after dark. You know, we want to be a 24-hour city. Mayor McGinn has talked about being a 24-hour city. There are parts of the city that where people do not want to go, and that has to change. And, you know, that would be – I think that is the focus, is that there is a sense that and a lot of the merchants feel this way, that there's a problem. It's an ongoing problem. You can question whether it's gotten worse or not, but it is a problem that needs to be solved that hasn't been solved.
What I would say here is that there's this rip-roaring debate about how you slice these statistics. And the city council members, the sheriff's wife, the Stranger, the Seattle Times, everybody's got a way to slice
Mrs.
and come
Burkhart.
Up with an analysis that works for them. But I'll tell you what, it's a very difficult argument if you have people talking about high-profile incidents or just a feeling, as you're speaking of, Skip. It's hard to argue no. You're wrong. You should feel safe. That is a very tough sell, which is why the mayor, once he was up against it there after the bus shooting and the council members came out, he tried to stop the argument with the investment in additional officers. And don't forget, it is on his record that during the recession, the city's obviously doing way, way better now, but during the recession, they stopped that police hiring program.
Now, there's not a lot on this year's ballot, but the other argument, the other issue that's going to be pretty high profile is I-522, which is the mandatory labeling of food products that contain genetically modified material, the GMO labeling. And what was interesting this week was that Monsanto just dumped $4.5 million into the anti-initiative fight. This similar measure written by the same people failed narrowly in California. And I believe that the anti-forces there were bankrolled in the tens of millions of dollars by
$44 million, right? Dollars versus $9 million. It's a bigger state. TV is more expensive.
But it's still, I mean, while we're looking for this to be like the liquor initiative, which was also bankrolled big time. At the same time that this money pours in, Elway does a poll that shows a big majority, 66% of the people questioned, think it's a good idea to have transparency and labeling. So do you think that this is going to capture voter imaginations or interests at all? Because it is kind of arcane. You have to dig into it.
I think it will. I think this is a state, and particularly this is a city, where people are actually very interested in this issue of where our food comes from, what's been done to it, whether science is our friend or our foe in this matter, and can you actually find evidence for the general concern that exists about the idea of genetic modification. So I think there will be a lot said about it and a lot of interest in it. And even if there's not burbling up interest right now, there will be after all this money is spent on TV ads.
Because we're going to see a lot of them. Is this something that captures your attention, Knut?
Yeah, it does. I mean, I'm completely in favor of the labeling, and I think the fact that those companies, Monsanto and whatnot, are so opposed to it, willing to spend such money, that to me that just underlines, you know, the fact that there's something bigger than just a label going on here, and I think it has to do with the way agriculture is conducted, who's in control of agriculture, who's in control of the food chain. I think it'd be great if it passed. And I can't, from a consumer standpoint, I can't really see what the argument against it is. People want to know what they're eating, where it comes from, and I think those big chemical companies would probably be smarter putting all that money into convincing people that GMO products taste better. Yes.
Or something.
And that's
like
probably what will be the next step.
What happened in California, as I understand it, is that California voters were about to approve this.
Yes.
The $44 million that was spent was up against $9 million by the proponents of labeling. And the argument that money bought was that it would cost so much more money to do the labeling, which I don't know. But labels, I don't know if
they already have labels.
I don't know if they're that expensive. But so that's how it changed. It shifted within a matter of days of a big, huge TV campaign statewide. And what this reminds me of, and I think I've mentioned this here before, is remember when state government was going to tax soda pop and candy, certain kinds of candy? And the beverage folks came into Washington State to the tune of $16 million, and that was the end of that.
Yeah. Well, the argument, similar one, was also used against the plastic bag ban. Mm-hmm. You know, you're going to have to buy grocery bags. You know, it's going to make your grocery trip more expensive and that kind of thing. And that's interesting that it worked in California. I mean, the good news is the poll showed a very sizable majority leaning in favor of the initiative. And so there's room for erosion.
It seems like there's two threads that are going through this. One is, you know, why not just label? We label all sorts of other stuff, calorie counts, fat percentages, saturated fat, you know, there's all sorts of things if you actually look at those labels. The other question is, you know, are GMO foods really bad for you? Which nobody really, I mean, I think some of the proponents will go there, but I think those are sort of different questions.
And that's a question that it would be great for local media to explore over the next several months. And I've said this before in a different context than this, I think the soda context and other big initiative context, but when you have millions of dollars in out-of-state money coming in to influence a statewide initiative, a huge percentage of that money goes to our local television stations for ads that run during, you know, the newscasts and so on local TV. And it doesn't seem, at least to me, that a large enough percentage of that haul for our local TV stations gets put into programming that actually seriously analyzes the issues that the ads are meant to confuse people on. And so my hope, and we'll see. We'll see. I'm not.
Are you laying down the gauntlet to your fellow journalists here?
No, the owners of the stations.
To the owners of the stations.
Yeah, it sounds like.
I mean, I posted about this on Slog this week, and I wrote about it a couple of years ago in The Stranger. But I am, and I'm not alone. David Domke at the UW asked the question a couple of years ago, what are these stations going to do with all this money? They're not doing enough so far. So, yes, it would be great to see them step up and do something worthwhile for the public with all these millions of dollars that Monsanto is putting in their pocket for ads that are going, you know, they're intended to not really inform but elicit an emotional response that will change the polling.
Well, these at least a couple of programs have been canceled that did that. So it was just the money came in. The shows did not occur.
Right. In the Slog post I put up this week, I pointed out that King 5 says it's expanding its local programming. It just made a big announcement about that. King 5 got the most, when I looked at TV ad money, it got the most of any station in the year that I looked at. But then right after that, the next year, it canceled up front with Robert Mack, which was the only public affairs program on our local TV networks. So if King 5 is going to expand its offerings, it would be nice to bring back something equivalent to or even bigger than Upfront with Robert Mack.
We're talking over the week's news with Eli Sanders, Joni Balter, Knute Berger, and interesting decision came down yesterday from the state Supreme Court. They ruled 7-2 that light rail indeed can go ahead and be put onto I-90. And this is it was interesting. It's sort of a personal defeat for Kemper Freeman, who has been the biggest or loudest or maybe most visible proponent of or opponent of mass transit, not just light rail, but mass transit in general. He's put his dollars there. Eli, you actually wrote about this week, but you've written about it before, and you put a clip from this past profile. You did a profile of Kemper Freeman, an interesting guy.
Right. Back in, I think it was 2011, when Kemper Freeman was backing an initiative, and again, this will sound familiar, you know, to the other topics that we're talking about, but he was trying to run an initiative that would have effectively thwarted light rail on I-90 without really saying that that's what its intent was. And so I went out to Bellevue to answer the question, who is this guy? And I looked at what is now decades of opposition by Kemper Freeman to anything that smells like light rail. He personally helped lead the 1995 and 1996 campaigns against creating it in the first place. He did the same for the 2008 campaign against extending light rail from Seattle to Bellevue. And then when those things didn't work, he started this lawsuit that he just lost at the state Supreme Court, millions of dollars from him to do this. He is a tough guy to figure out. If you go to the Slog, you can see the link to the profile I wrote of him into a long interview with him. But essentially, he believes that he's right and everyone else has been brainwashed by Sound Transit into thinking that this will actually improve traffic in our region.
Now, I know, Joni, you worked for him, didn't you, at one point?
No, I did not.
I thought at a radio station years
ago.
No,
my station was owned by Stu Ballinger.
He was a radio station. I've interviewed Kemper Freeman as well.
He owned a different station.
A different station. Yeah. Knute, did you do a lot of interaction with him when you were working on the east side?
Oh, well, sure. And anybody who writes about Bellevue or visits Bellevue or has any civic interest in Bellevue, Kemper Freeman has been the huge presence over there. And Bellevue itself is sort of the Seattle of the east side in the sense of what happens in Bellevue has effects all over. And, I mean, I think with Kemper, there's a combination here of ideology and self-interest. His business model is designed and built for a certain kind of car-centric, urban, suburban model. And ideologically, he has long been a conservative Republican. So, and his family, going back to grandfather, Miller Freeman and Kemper Sr. and then Kemper Jr., I mean, they have exercised enormous influence on the shaping of Bellevue and the shaping of the East Side.
Didn't they own most of downtown Bellevue at some point?
Well, they still do. and in fact, they purchased it from other but there's the Bellevue Square property. They now run the Lincoln across the way. And all along
the Arts Center.
But they
own that property as well?
An Arts Center.
Yeah. They played a key role in assembling those properties and developing those properties. And so I think Kemper has had I think he had an ideological resistance to the idea of creating a new public agency in Sound Transit, and I think it's a lot of it just comes down to the fact that he doesn't think rail will be good for business.
The interesting thing in that ruling was this reference to documents from the 70s that suggested that the planners of all of that envisioned light rail in the future having a priority. I thought that was one of the more interesting parts of the ruling.
I was just going to say, in relation to Kemper Freeman, he's also sort of in a different universe than a lot of the other people who are arguing about this issue. He doesn't believe global warming is a real thing. So if you're trying to make an environmentalist argument for light rail, he doesn't even really recognize it as valid. One interesting wrinkle here when we're talking about the history, Miller Freeman, Kemper's grandfather, essentially had I-90 built. He is responsible for I-90, the bridge that his grandson is now, you know, fighting tooth and nail and losing. He's now lost, I think.
I don't think there's any other...
Well, but if you look at his history, he will try to find a way.
Very briefly, before we say goodbye until next week, among the zillions of people who are going to be at CenturyLink Field on Sunday trying to break a world decibel loudness record, or however you say it, will be Mr. Mosbach himself. I've got your vocal cords ready.
I do. My son, who's not going to the game but is a huge Seahawks fan, warned me that if I had a voice on Monday morning, I'd be in big trouble.
This is actually, there are two big games happening at CenturyLink. I guess you don't call it a game, you call it a match, but the Sounders play for first place in this evening, and then the Seahawks take on the San Francisco 49ers, and this is going to be broadcast nationally because this game is a really big deal and tickets are going for hundreds of dollars at this point. But yesterday we spoke with the editor of a national soccer newspaper, and I asked about loudness, and he said soccer loudness is better than football loudness because we create our own original kinds of things. So that's just a slap down. Sounders fans, Seahawks fans, I think that you better be wearing some kind of ear protection, Knut.
Yeah, that's probably it. It'll all those rock concerts I went to, maybe.
Oh, maybe you've gone deaf already.
Maybe helped, yeah.
Knut Berger is the Mosbach at crosscut.com. Eli Sanders, associate editor at The Stranger. Joni Balter, assistant political editor for the Seattle Times. Thanks for coming in today, all three of you. The Week in Review is produced by Jason Pagano. Bernard Willett's our engineer. I'm Marcy Silman. Join me again with this panel next week at 10 here on KUOW.
Earth, Wind, and Fire has a new record coming out, their first in 8 years. We'll talk with the group's bassist and hear some of their new music at 11:45. KUOW-FM Seattle, KUOW-Tumwater, KQOW-Bellingham, and Digital HD Services.
Support for KUOW comes from the 2013 Boats Afloat Show, September 11th through 15th at South Lake Union in Seattle. With hundreds of new and used boats, from sailboats and sports boats to mega yachts, sailing packages available for adults and life jackets for kids. Tickets and information online at boatsafloatshow.com.
45 years ago, Charlie Hoy was an Army photographer in Vietnam. But he never looked back at what he'd shot until recently, when a friend digitized hundreds of his negatives.
Took them home and put them in my computer and set them up on a 2-second delay and sat there and watched them all and literally didn't sleep for 3 days.
Coming up on The Story, a return to images of the past.
This afternoon at 2 on KUOW's second program service, KUOW.